Case number 12-3094, United States of America v. Jacqueline L. Wheeler, appellant. Mr. Herman for the appellant, Ms. Kelly for the appellee.
May it please the court, I'm Stephen Herman and I represent the appellant, Dr. Jacqueline Wheeler. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I intend to focus my argument first on the issue surrounding Defense Exhibit 16 and second on the application of the abuse of a position of trust enhancement. The district court's rulings regarding Defense Exhibit 16 gutted Dr. Wheeler's defensive mistake. The district court allowed the government to admit documents, including all the super bills comprising Defense Exhibit 16, through the testimony of a summary witness as evidence of fraudulent intent. But the district court precluded the defense from cross-examining the same summary witness with...
What was the purpose of the cross-examination of Agent Coates? What was the objective?
Well, the objective is that Agent Coates is being held out by the government as a knowledgeable guide to this body of documents. She said,
and the purpose was to show that she didn't know what the super bills were either, right? They were difficult to understand.
Well, I don't think that's the purpose. Okay. So Agent Coates, I view it slightly differently.
Okay.
Agent Coates has said, I've looked at all these documents. I can make a representation to you, the jury. They don't support Dr. Wheeler's billing practices or any of the claims submitted by health advocacy. And what the defense wants to do with that same pile of documents is pull them out and say to her, what about this? What about this? And they completely contradict what she has represented about those documents. And they undermine her credibility. They undermine the point the government's making that there's no documentary support for Dr. Wheeler's billing practices.
So credibility is the term. Her credibility was seriously questioned anyway by the cross-examination.
How much more did you need?
Well, I think that if you have two super bills, you're not at the point where you're showing that it's more than a coincidence. If you have 348 super bills, and I'm not saying you have to show her all 348, but at the point where you're only at two, you haven't shown that, you haven't made your point as effectively as you can. And I think we point out in our brief that if you were able to question with a significant number more, not only is Agent Coates' credibility hurt more, but you also are showing bias. She's already testified that she looked at these documents very carefully, giving the benefit of the doubt to the defense. And if you can show that her review of these documents is not only not credible, but it's also biased, that's a pretty compelling point for the defense to be able to make. And we'd also point out that the document should have been admissible. Agent Coates is a summary witness, and a summary witness...
Why didn't you put on your own witnesses to admit that? Well, I mean, you were invited to do that. Foundational testimony, that's not too difficult to do. Why didn't you do that?
Well, under the government's theory of the case, Dr. Wheeler is the person who's the biller. And so what is really happening is the idea that you need to lay additional foundation first presupposes that the foundation isn't already laid for the documents.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's not a big deal. Laying foundation is not too difficult to do. Why didn't you all do that? I mean,
well,
it was clearly foreclosed from you by the judge's rulings. One way you can do it is say, we'll take it up on appeal. Another way you can do it is just put on a witness to get them admitted.
Judge Griffith, the court's ruling keeps out a key piece of defense evidence, and basically what the court is saying, and that's a prejudicial error is our point. And what the court is saying...
It's prejudicial, but it's easily surmounded.
Well,
and the trial counsel chose not to do that.
Under the defense's theory of the case, Dr. Wheeler is the biller, and the remedy for a prejudicial error and to mitigate it and to preserve the issue for appeal, you don't have to, as a defendant, take the stand to lay a foundation for documents and waive your Fifth Amendment rights. Now, the foundation's already laid for these documents. It's not a cure to an error to say, well, you can mitigate it by waiving your Fifth Amendment rights as a defendant. What's already happened is...
Was there nobody else who could lay the foundation for it besides Ms. Wheeler?
Well, that's not in the record, but what is in the record is that Agent Coates has already used this pile of documents as a summary witness. When you're a summary witness and you're testifying about documents, the necessary corollary to that is the documents that you're testifying about. The foundation has already been laid. They are admissible. And the defense should have been able to use them. The defense doesn't need to put it on as an affirmative point in its case. If the government's presenting that this pile of documents supports fraudulent intent and builds on their case, the defense has every right in the government's case to attack that point and to knock it out in the government's case if there's already sufficient foundation for the documents and the use of them, and they've already been admitted.
Can I ask you about Defendant's Exhibit 16A, part of DX-16? Is there any evidence as to who? It wasn't Wheeler who wrote in these numbers, was it? 1 and 8 and 33 and 80?
Well, Judge Henderson, there's no testimony about who wrote the numbers in or not, and that's part of the government's point in attacking the documents, and that's perfectly permissible for the government to do. But you still can use the documents to attack credibility, to omit them, to support your point, and then the government's free to attack them in any way it wants to do so. And I think, at least in terms of cross-examination, what the court says in Davis versus Alaska is a good point on that, where the court says, look, we don't know if the defense would if the jury would necessarily believe this cross-examination. They're the sole people who assess credibility. But the defense, if it has a legitimate theory, should get to put that on and test her credibility the way that the defense wants to do so. With regard, if there are no further questions on Defense Exhibit 16, I'll move on to the abuse of position of trust. With regard to the abuse of a position of private trust sentencing enhancement, although the sentencing guidelines already severely punish someone for defrauding Medicaid, the district court
What was the argument you made about this district court?
Well, the argument in district court was that the position, abuse of position of trust did not apply, and that...
Why? I thought it was because that Hastings was in control. Wasn't that the gravamen of your argument there, that Hastings was in control, therefore the enhancement didn't apply? And yet here you're making a different argument. You're making a more general argument that anyone who submits a Medicaid bill is a person who's not in a position of trust. And an argument the 11th Circuit has adopted and no one else has. Those are different arguments.
Well, I think that what was raised below was that there was no position of trust, and I do agree with you that they pointed to facts as to her relationship with
her. We're here on plain error review, right?
Well, I don't think that's true.
Wait a second. You didn't make this argument below, and you're making it now. Well, that's classic plain error review.
Our position is that plain error doesn't apply here because it just...
Wait a second. Did you make this argument below? Did you argue below that a person who submits a Medicaid bill inherently does not occupy a position of trust? Was that an argument you made?
I don't think, Judge Griffith, I will acknowledge we did not make that exact argument below.
You didn't make that argument below.
We did not make that argument below in the sense that...
We're here on plain error review, and if you've got a circuit split, or you've got all these circuits going a different way than you're arguing right now, that a fortiori, that cannot be plain error, right?
Well, I'm not sure that it can't be plain error because of the recent Supreme Court decision in U.S. v. Henderson. But I still contend that we are not here on plain error review because the district court, what happened here is the defense raises an issue. They say she doesn't occupy a position of trust. Mm-hmm. I will agree they did not argue it the exact way we are arguing it here. But the district court...
They keep saying the exact way, but they didn't make it at all. They didn't make this argument at all, that by virtue of the fact that you submit bill to Medicaid, you are not in a position of trust. That's the argument we have before us now. That argument was not made at all. Stop saying it wasn't exactly made that way.
Well, Judge what the defense said in the sentencing, in arguing that the abuse of position of trust was sufficient to alert the court to this issue, and the court passed upon this issue, pointing to the exact cases that the government's now pointing to.
The court passed upon the issue of whether a person who submits a Medicaid bill occupies a position of trust?
I believe it did. It said that there are these cases out there that say that people who are managers and run healthcare clinics who submit bills to Medicaid occupy positions of trust. And it said that there are cases out there that support that proposition, which is exactly the position that the government's now arguing on appeal.
Okay, I'll have to look at that again. I didn't notice that.
So essentially what happened here is the district court took facts inherent in any Medicaid fraud and turned them into an enhancement. I see that my time's about to be up. So for the reasons we've stated in our brief and that I've argued here today, we believe that Dr. Wheeler, this should be granted a new trial, or in the alternative, that this case should be remanded for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Herman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States.
Could you address my point that the opposing counsel says that even if the enhancement argument that's being made now wasn't made exactly the same way it was below, that actually the district court did address the argument they're making now. Is that right?
I don't believe that is correct. There is a point during the sentencing at which the judge, in responding to the argument that was raised by the defendant in the district court, said that, that even if you're an office manager, for instance, which was one of the arguments that the defendant was making, there is case law to support that even office managers have been found to have abused a position of trust. The court was not opining particularly or ruling on an argument that somebody who is a Medicaid provider is necessarily in a position of trust. That argument absolutely was not made below in any way, shape, or form by the defense counsel. And the court's comments about other cases where people had been found in positions of trust was not based and was not ruling on an argument that a Medicaid provider is in that position. What the defendant raised below was an argument factually that at most Dr. Wheeler was an office manager level person running HAC, and that she and Dr. Hastings ran HAC jointly and had access to bank accounts.
Yeah, as I recall, and the focus was on the nature of the relationship. HAC, not the nature of the relationship.
That's correct. There was no argument about the nature of the relationship with Medicaid. It was just what is Dr. Wheeler's role within HAC itself. And that's the point that the court was ruling on in making the comments there. So we believe this certainly is plain error. This is not this is a completely new argument that's raised now on appeal. And there's nothing about the Supreme Court's decision in Henderson this summer that changes the fact that this is plain error review. This isn't a matter of a law changing between the time of trial and the time of appeal, for instance.
What is your response to counsel's argument that this reliance is an element of fraud, so there shouldn't be a separate enhancement? In other words, the trust, people have to have confidence in you or trust or something for you to even pull off a fraud. So I think his argument is it's all the same thing.
Yeah, it's very different, as numerous courts have ruled, when you have a Medicaid or a Medicare provider and their relationship with Medicaid, or even private insurers. That's a different relationship. The Second Circuit and the Fourth Circuit have both held that those providers are in a fiduciary relationship with Medicaid. And then there have been, additionally, there's circuits that, in addressing whether a medical provider is in that sort of position of trust with an insurer such as Medicaid, they've applied that not only to medical doctors, but they've applied it to people such as ambulance company operators who are not holding themselves out as the person who gave treatment, for instance. So there's the majority of the circuits who have considered issues about whether or not there's a particular abuse of trust when you're somebody who's going to an insurer for payment or a Medicaid provider, they've held that that is a special position of trust.
I know that a number of circuits have said that. There are lots of cases out there that support your side of this argument, but I'm more interested in the analysis. Why is there a fiduciary relationship? Why is it different from just a contractual relationship? I mean, in other words, does Medicare or Medicaid really trust these people? Isn't that why they have financial intermediaries? Isn't that why they constantly do audits?
Well, as the case law says, that is one of the points that in Miller, in Bolden, in the Wright cases, the trust is there because they rely on the people who are submitting the billing, the Medicaid providers, to be providing them with accurate information. And it's very difficult in Medicaid cases to do the sort of investigation that's necessary to detect fraud at all, because you do have people...
Doesn't that suggest a systemic problem here? If the trust, if they're relying on all these people, maybe that's...
Well, it, because of the very nature of people who are providing health care and not being seen day in, day out by the Medicaid itself, you do rely on this. And it's an ongoing relationship. It's not just once in a situation where, for instance, you're becoming a government contractor and negotiating a contract, that sort of thing. But it's an ongoing relationship.
The question that arises, I think, is where do you draw that line? Are there all kinds of people who have relationships with the government in which there's an element of trust, taxpayers, for instance, right? Would taxpayers then be subject to this enhancement?
No, I don't believe so, because when you go back and you look at 3B1.3, which is the abuse of trust increase language, a position of trust is characterized by professional or managerial discretion, and that's exactly what you have here. You have Dr. Wheeler, who is the CEO of HAC, she's the one who signed the provider agreement with Medicaid when HAC became a Medicaid provider in 2002, which holds her responsible.
What's the professional expertise for filling out a form and reporting what you've done to the government for reimbursement, for payment?
It doesn't have to be professional expertise. It's that you are in the position of managerial discretion as CEO, where you are in charge. In this case, she did the billing. There's vast evidence that she was the one that did all of HAC's billing.
So maybe you couldn't hold individual taxpayers responsible, but what if you're a Chapter S corporation?
It's possible. I haven't looked into it, but if you're the accountant for a Chapter S corporation, perhaps you are in a position of trust. I don't know that that exists, but certainly when you look at the Medicaid and the insurance realm, all the circuits except the 11th Circuit that have addressed this says that if you are a Medicaid provider, you do have that special relationship of trust. And because we're on plain error and there's a split in the circuits and this court has not made a decision, there's no way you can say that any error that occurred here was plain. And, in fact, there was no error here. Just going back to the sheer facts of this case, when you look at her position within HAC, it shows that she did have managerial discretion. She's the CEO. Again, she's the one that signed the Medicaid provider agreement as HAC's CEO. She exclusively did HAC's Medicaid billing. And again, we have a situation here where it's clear that Medicaid is not able to double-check every single claim that comes in. There was evidence at trial that they got DC Medicaid through its company that did the handling of the billing, got 8,000 to 12,000 claims a day, and that they didn't manually review these electronic claims because there's just so many. And unless there's a claim that's suspended, for instance, if you send in a duplicate claim, that's the sort of thing that flags it. But Medicaid relies on the trust of...
I understand the difficulty, and I understand the argument that it's very difficult, if not impossible, for them to actually carefully consider every bill that they're receiving. It's just that, to me, when you talk about managerial discretion, it suggests something, because what you're looking at is the ability to conceal the theft or whatever you're doing that you shouldn't be doing. But here, if you apply that, every government program has that problem.
Well, it's the ability to conceal or to facilitate the commission of the offense. And when you're the CEO and you're the Medicaid provider who signed off saying that I understand the rules of Medicaid and I'm the one who's responsible for following them, you are in a different position than somebody who's just, who's a secretary, for instance, who's filling out those bills and passing them up the chain. She is the sole connection, and there's a lot of evidence at trial that she was the one who was, in fact, calling Medicaid to check up on billings and so forth. She is the connection with Medicaid, and she's taken on that responsibility by signing that Medicaid provider agreement, saying that she's going to be the one responsible for handling Medicaid and, of course, handling it properly in regard to HAC. So that is a special relationship with Medicaid. And again, it used her managerial discretion and her position as CEO allowed her not to be caught and to commit these crimes because no one else is watching her.
If Wheeler had not been the one signing off and had delegated that to an employee, what would you say about an employee who was the final say, so that that employee might be subject to this breach of trust enhancement? What would your position be with respect to Wheeler at the top of it, but not actually having any participation in it, simply being responsible ultimately for it?
I mean, if Wheeler is the person who's the defendant, but she's not actually the person who's sending in the forms or reviewing the forms, that may not be a situation where she is using that position to facilitate the commission of the crime. You know, maybe she should have been more responsible in reviewing the billing, but I don't know if in that situation you could say that she had used her position of trust to facilitate the commission of the crime. But that's not what we have here. We have substantial, overwhelming even evidence that she was exclusively doing HACS Medicaid billing here, and she was the CEO, and she was the one who had signed the Medicaid provider agreement.
So you can imagine situations where someone sends a bill to Medicaid and they're not abusing the position of trust.
It's possible, given your position within the company itself, if you're just a secretary or just a person who's the biller in the office, for instance, that may not be a position of trust because you don't have that sort of professional managerial discretion that 3B1.3 is calling for.
Let me ask you a question about double jeopardy. Your opposing counsel didn't use this in his oral argument, but can you come up with a specific example of how Section 1347 might be violated in a circumstance where Section 1035 was not violated?
Well, I believe if you're in a situation where, for instance, you're planning a scheme to hand in fraudulent billing to Medicaid, for instance, but you actually haven't put in any bills yet to Medicaid that are fraudulent. If you're planning this scheme, you're attempting a scheme.
You're sitting around in your kitchen coming up with a scheme, but you haven't acted.
But you haven't acted on it yet. That's a potential situation where you're attempting to commit a scheme, but you haven't.
Would the difference only be whether there's an attempt or a completed?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you're, say, for instance, you're part of it. And another scenario I was thinking of is if you're somebody who really isn't a licensed doctor and you are giving patients unnecessary treatment and you've done that and that's part of your scheme, but you haven't yet handed in the bills to Medicaid. You haven't yet made a false statement. And again, I think the important thing under Blockberger is you're looking at the elements and the fact that there is a possibility that you could attempt a scheme or commit a scheme without actually having made a false statement.
So you think takes place when someone who's not licensed is holding themselves out as a physician, but then they decide not to submit a bill for Medicaid reimbursement? Has a health care fraud crime been committed then?
Somebody's
in their clinic, they're doing work for them, but their plan is that they're going to try to get reimbursement from Medicaid for this, but then they don't ever approach Medicaid about it.
These are parts of it that could be, yes. There's nothing in the statute that says a scheme has to be committed.
That's health care fraud? I mean, that may be practicing medicine without a license or something, but is it health care fraud?
It's certainly an attempt, we would say. And I think the important thing under Blockberger is that you're looking at the elements. You're not looking at the means. You're not looking at what are the facts of this particular case in determining. You're focused on the
statutory. So the facts don't matter. Even if the health care fraud is carried out by means of misrepresentation, which would be a false statement.
Well, that's correct. I mean, the Albernaz case said in the Supreme Court that you can satisfy Blockberger even if there's substantial overlap of proof in a case. So if you have a case as this one where you have 1035 false claims that are statements and you have 1347, it doesn't matter that you have very similar proof. You still have the fact that 1035 requires proof that the defendant made a false statement, but 1347 does not. And there's additional case law, particularly in the Sixth and Seventh Circuits.
So the way you distinguish them, as I understand it, is you can imagine an attempt that doesn't involve a false statement.
Right? Correct, correct. You could be planning to undertake this with cohorts in your office, but not having gotten to the point where you've actually submitted the billing that would be the false statement. That could be an attempt at a scheme. But again, just the fact that you can imagine facts doesn't mean that it fails the Blockberger test. And the defense hasn't pointed to a single case where circuits found that 1347 and 1035 taken together and convicted together or sentenced together is a situation that invokes double jeopardy. And additionally, there's case law.
They're part of the same statutory scheme. Right?
They are. Right. They are. And in the Sixth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit have both said, too, that 1347 requires proof of a defendant's specific intent to deceive, and that 1035 doesn't require that. So that's an additional element that we believe is in 1347 that does not match up with 1035.
Going back for a moment to Judge Griffith's hypothetical, I may be wrong, but let's say the provider who is not a doctor asks for the Medicaid card of the supposed patient he's going to treat. I would think the submission of the Medicaid card to the doctor, filling out the required paperwork to even be seen by a doctor that we all have to do now, would be enough once this fake doctor sees the person to be an attempt.
No, we would agree with you on that, Your Honor.
I assume people have Medicaid cards just like people with insurance, and they have to produce those before anyone will even see you. I think that's right.
Okay. If Your Honors have any questions about the first issue in regard to the admission of DX-16, we'd be happy to answer those. But our point mainly on that issue was that ultimately the proponent of the evidence has to produce sufficient evidence to support a finding that item is in fact what the proponent claims. Mm-hmm. And here defense counsel was trying to use this not just to attack Agent Coates' credibility, but they wanted to use these documents to make an argument as to the biller's state of mind. And until they did not in this case, present any evidence showing that a biller used these, what they were, or how or if they were presented.
Could they have done that without calling Ms. Wheeler?
Well, we don't believe so, because we believe that those were documents that were created by Ms. Wheeler. But that aside, it's very clear from Agent Coates' testimony
that put them in the Fifth Amendment. But how are they supposed to do that?
Well, there were other, as the court noted, there were numerous other people who had been called to testify who worked at HAC. And those documents could have been presented or attempted to be presented through them as well. And the point
was the only one who did the billing, though. Would they have been able to testify as to what?
If they had seen them, for instance, if they'd seen her use them, for instance, that's a possibility. It doesn't have to be her necessarily. But the point is you still have to show how these were used or if they were used to bill Medicaid. Agent Coates clearly did not know. She said that, these documents might find in patient files, but I don't know what they mean. They don't look like super bills that I've ever seen before. I don't understand what any of these columns mean. There's no procedure codes on them. And ultimately, they were able to get out of Agent Coates that potentially those documents could support the submitted bills if someone could explain them or if there was some other notation in the patient files as to each date and each procedure. So they got everything they could out of Agent Coates. There's no need to have her go through this 346 more times. And until you, as the proponent of those documents, can show how they relate to Medicaid billing or if they relate to Medicaid billing, they just can't come in because they have no conditional relevancy under 901. So for all those reasons, we would respectfully request that the judgment of the court be affirmed.
Does the court have any further questions?
I don't. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Herman, you had no time left. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to start off by just making a quick point about the conditional relevancy point. Now, the government's here contending, well, you can't connect these to billing practices or use these documents to suggest something about billing practices, but that's exactly what Agent Coates did. Right out of the box of her testimony on, I believe it's JA 630, and let me get the, make sure I have the page right, but JA 632 to 33, the government asked, you reviewed all these documents seized from Dr. Wheeler's house, and what, if anything, did they show you about Dr. Wheeler's billing practices? And Agent Coates says there's not enough documentation to support her billing practices. Agent Coates also acknowledged that super bills are often used in billing, are always used in billing, typically used in billing. That's what a super bill is used for, as did another witness who had a background in medical billing. Now, Agent Coates said, I don't recognize these super bills or these don't look like things, and that's fine. You can use that to underscore the government to argue lack of reliability, but the conditional relevancy of these documents is already established. It's further established by the fact that the district court allowed in Defense Exhibit 16A and 16B for exactly the purpose that the government or the defense wanted to use the rest of the documents for. In terms of the abusive position of trust enhancement, I'd like to address Judge Brown's point about this resource issue. The abusive position of trust isn't about resources. If it was every position where the government or other people, private parties, couldn't detect fraud, suddenly turn that into abusive position of trust, the abusive position of trust enhancement would be extremely expansive. Not only would it apply to potentially where the government wants to take it with Medicaid fraud, but it would also apply to small businesses where you didn't have the resources to police people you were contracting with or things like that. All we have here is the submission of anonymous bills by Health Advocacy Center to Medicaid and Medicaid paying them. That's fraud. It's not an abusive position of trust. The government was not deferring to Dr. Wheeler because of who Dr. Wheeler was. The government had to prove up that Dr. Wheeler, through circumstantial evidence, was the biller here. There's nothing about Dr. Wheeler's relationship with them that caused her Medicaid to defer to her in any different way. All they did was rely on these bills in the general way people rely on any number of fraudulent or allegedly fraudulent submissions in a fraud case.
Thank you, Mr. Herman.